Hello and welcome to the latest episode of II's The ETFs Show. My name is Tom Bailey and I'm the ETFs editor at II. So on today's show, we're joined by Mark Makepeace. Mark is a veteran of the City of London, having started working for the Stock Exchange in the 1980s. Most notably, however, he was founding chief executive of FTSE International and for decades oversaw the creation of the FTSE brand and indices. He recently offered a new book, FTSE, The Inside Story, which tells the history of how this now iconic British brand was created. So Mark, the FTSE 100 is launched in 1984, but perhaps we should start with what was used as a performance index for UK stocks before then.
There were two things. I mean, you had the FT30 that gave you the sort of the immediate what was happening during the day. Sometimes there were issues with that. There's a wonderful story where some of the price reporters from the FT who used to collect the prices from the stock exchange floor, the person who was due to collect the prices one morning had a dentist appointment, and therefore the market was sharply down, and yet the index was static. And I think a trader rang up to complain. Someone told them that, the price collector is out at the dentist, but as soon as he comes back in later this morning, he'll make sure the index gets updated quickly. So there were stories like that in the early days. And of course, the actuaries in the UK then stepped in and they started to develop, you know, what has become the sort of the all share index, which became then the performance benchmark for funds in the UK.
At the time, 1984, you have in the US at this point, the Dow and the S&P. Was the UK unique in having this kind of relatively unsophisticated index, or was that the global norm at the time?
Well, no, I think the FT followed the Dow Jones. If you think about the Dow Jones, it's a price-weighted index of 30 stocks, and the FT very much sort of followed the Dow Jones itself. It's only when the S&P was adopted for futures that really the London market, taking its lead from the US, wanted to develop a better index to support the launch of futures on the life market. All of the parties eventually got together. The London Stock Exchange and Life started the initiative. The actuaries helped out. And it was only in the very late stages that the FT itself got involved.
You mentioned this in your book, the kind of uneasy relationship with the FT. I was wondering if you could explain this this kind of story. It's quite interesting.
Well, there was rivalry because the FT produced indices for the UK market, not just the FT30. Then they collaborated with the actuaries. So I think the FT saw themselves as the market standard and the reporter of what was going on in the market. And here was two challenges, really, that the market was moving to much greater technology, much more real time, which moved it away from the FT. And of course, you had this upstart, the London Stock Exchange, coming in and wanting to calculate not only a new index, but one that was calculated electronically and calculated on a much quicker, faster basis than the FT could match. So you then had the FT eventually coming together with the stock exchange, because I think the combination of the two, you know, really launched the FTSE 100. I think if the FTSE 100 had been promoted just by the exchange, I don't think it would have been as quick a success as it was.
So if you fast forward to the 1990s, at this point, FTSE International is operationally an independent company. Could you give a kind of brief overview of how this developed from the initial launch of the indices in 84 and then kind of your role in it?
I was asked to get involved in the indices for the UK market in the early 90s. I spent the first couple of years then working with the actuaries, the FT and the exchange, and really trying to get those through three bodies to collaborate and work together. And we did that successfully. We launched the mid-250, we extended the coverage of the all-share, and we launched the FTSE small cap. So we had had some success in collaborating. We also collaborated on defining a new, more modern industry classification. So the next step was to try and solidify that and make it much more permanent. And I think that was the challenge in setting up FTSE. But we finally achieved that in 95, but we were very much a startup. On the first day, there were just nine of us, and The revenues were very small. We had to rebuild systems, develop the strategy for expansion. But it was very much a startup, and it had a startup mentality. And I think that helped us enormously.
You mentioned the FTSE 250. I was wondering if you walk us through the kind of decision making to create this new index. Because I remember in the book, you mentioned kind of you seemed to consult with several fund managers across the UK and kind of, you know, what was the demand, who was arguing for it or anyone against it?
It was a strange case because we'd taken our lead from the US, where they had introduced a mid-cap for the US market. And I was convinced that there was a mid-cap group of stocks in the UK. And we had this gap that existed between the FTSE 100 and the small-cap index at the time was the Horgavet small-cap index. So there was a gap and there were a number of stocks there that were simply not being covered because they sat between those two main indices. So I argued that we should actually start to think about the whole market and we should think about developing a mid-cap immediately below the FTSE 100. And it seemed like, to me, a sensible idea. But I took that out to the largest 30 fund managers in the UK. And when we reviewed the results, I think there were only two fund managers that supported us. I think there were 28 that said this was nonsense. There was no mid-cap effect in the UK. The UK market was much smaller than the US, and it wasn't needed. But undeterred and working with the actuaries and the FT, I convinced a smaller group that we should go ahead, and we did that. We went back a year later, and of course, the impact of introducing the index meant that mid-cap stocks had their best year and had outperformed large and small caps during that year. And of course, we went back to those same 30 fund managers and we found that the vast majority of them now recognise that there was a mid-cap effect and some of them even started mid-cap funds. The lesson I learned was that, you can consult, but if you're trying to innovate, you can't just ask permission. You have to take a chance. You have to take a risk.
And at what point did you start to try and construct indices representing overseas markets? So you mentioned in the book the FTSE ASE index for Greece and then several attempts in China.
We inherited from the FT a global index, and there were a number of partners to that index. I mean, Goldman Sachs was a partner. S&P actually was a partner. The coverage wasn't as good as MSCI. The coverage was limited. And therefore, I bought out the Goldman Sachs and S&P at the time. And I also bought the ING Barings Emerging Markets, which were probably one of the best known emerging market indices at that time. And yeah. I put that together. And that's when I really started to focus on international markets, because I could see that MSCI needed a competitor. I received a lot of encouragement from international investors to create that competitor. But without the acquisitions, it would have taken us a very long time. So with those acquisitions, we still had to innovate. We had to expand the coverage so that we had deeper coverage than the MSCI. We introduced stronger governance, defining, emerging and developed markets in much more detail, creating engagement with those markets. And that's when we found ourselves starting to engage with markets that either were not covered or were probably in the wrong category. And we came up against the political issue of, if you demote or promote a country, that's a huge change. Investors, global investors want stability. But if you are to have a robust system, you need to create the rules and you need to ensure that you stick to those rules. And therefore, there were some difficult decisions. Demoting Greece was a difficult decision because, we had, looking back, wrongly promoted it when the euro was created. We promoted Portugal and Greece to develop. And it wasn't until the financial crisis that really we then took what I think it was the right decision, was to put Greece in the emerging markets category. But it took us some time to get there. And we worked very hard with the Greek authorities and the Greek market to constantly keep improving their market. But it was just, in the end, the financial crisis was just too much for that market, and liquidity in that market dried up. We demoted it.
That's an interesting point. Also, kind of, you mentioned the decision of FTSE to promote South Korea to develop market status, whereas our listeners will know the MSCI, one of the biggest competitors, keeps it still in EM status. And that, as you say, kind of affects billions of dollars of fund flows. And then I guess more recently, another competitor of the FTSE, the S&P, decision to add Tesla, again, shows the power of, because now all these fund managers have to go and buy Tesla. It shows the power of index providers in the decision-making.
And I think in the early days, I think the governance lacked the robustness and oversight that it has today. But you still have different approaches from different index providers. So yeah. FTSE, I would say, is very methodical in its approach. It sort of analyzes everything. It gets it builds a consensus amongst the big fund management houses that use these indices. But it sort of almost constructs these indices in a very sort of building block approach. So it takes the whole market. It then from there removes stocks that do not meet its criteria, removes countries that do not meet its criteria. It engages to ensure that those criteria are understood and that everyone has a chance to meet them. And it builds from that base. You know, S&P has a different approach. S&P is much more take an approach, particularly on the US market, where it will keep some stocks out for longer and will make more judgments on its rules, based around its rules. It is still rule-driven, but it just has a slightly different approach. Tesla's a good example, but there are many others.
The FTSE, correct me if I'm wrong, there's no kind of these profitability requirements that the S&P has.
That's right.
The 500 index, and then the DAX is looking at introducing some new profitability requirements. I suppose you're not a fan of such approach, or do you just think it's different attempt?
If you think about it, what the index is meant to do is to capture the investability opportunity, and that investment opportunity includes companies that do not make a profit. If you had bought Tesla at a much earlier stage in your portfolio, you would have benefited enormously. So by setting governance and profitability standards, you know, you're really not representing that investable universe, if you want to think of it that way. The broad-based indices have a role to show what the market itself is doing. Now, there are some problems there because, you know, as the index funds, the passive funds, need to track and follow these indices. You know, you do need some liquidity criteria. Otherwise, you distort prices. And it's been argued you need some governance standards. So, for instance, in my time, I stood up against Snap because the shares for normal investors, there were no voting rights attached to those, none at all. So investors had no real opportunity to express their displeasure or to express their wish for change. So we did stand up on that issue. But again, there are more and more companies that do have voting restrictions. So you have to be careful. If we go too far, the index is distorted because it no longer properly represents the whole market. So there is a balance you have to strike.
So back to the FTSE 100, in the book you recount how the index became increasingly international in the 2000s, particularly with kind of major mining companies looking to list on the LSE with seemingly explicit intention of getting included in the FTSE 100 index. So I wonder if you could explain like kind of why this happened and what the general reaction was at the time.
Yes, I think the UK market adopted indexation, very much like the US market. And of course, the reputation of the UK for good governance was attracting all kinds of foreign listed companies. And the sort of passive funds were almost forced buyers of these stocks. So we had a number of companies that were coming to the market. Many of them had international shareholders who had a majority stake. And that started to create issues for us, because suddenly, you know, if there were any issues, if there were any risks, it was very difficult for investors, again, to influence those shareholders. So we started then to try and address that problem by insisting that companies abide by the takeover panel rules. And we started to go in some ways beyond the regulatory requirements. But there was pressure on both us and the regulators to increase the criteria for companies coming to the market. And it was simply because, again, those people following the indices, those passive investors, were forced buyers. We felt was distorting the market. So we started to step by step introduce rules to help us control that, so that we were trying to represent companies that were considered to some degree, had their sort of either head office or were based out of London and decision making was made out of London, and investors, domestic UK investors, had an ability to enforce the takeover panel and other requirements that, you know, they had with other UK stocks. So that was the thinking. But it did take us time, because we were feeling our way and we came under enormous political pressure to try to include as many companies as possible. Because at the time, I think politicians felt that it was good for the UK. You know, many large fund managers started to speak out against it, and slowly we built a consensus and found a way to managing this and getting the sort of right approach. But it did take us time.
I think for many UK investors, the international nature of the FTSE 100 index kind of became very apparent following the devaluation of sterling in 2016 and the fact that it had little correlation with the UK economy. What do you make of it? And does it matter? Should it matter?
More and more companies are becoming international. As we move to a digital world, I think more and more companies are moving to becoming international. I mean, the UK now, you can argue that there's, you know, less than 25% of the FTSE 100 is actually exposed to the UK economy. So it is, and it will continue to reduce. You know, and as the UK is successful and UK companies are successful in growing their businesses globally, you would expect that to decrease. And we shouldn't try and prevent that. But those who do want to then invest into the UK and solely into the UK, or to capture what would be changes in the UK economy, they need to look at smaller companies. And that's where I think the 250 has played an important role. And that's where I think small cap indices play an important role. But we will see even those indices become more international, because small companies today, with the digital technology that's available, you know, are becoming themselves much more global.
I suppose you could reach a situation where kind of different indices around the world become clustered around certain types of stocks. So the, you know, the US index is dominated by tech. That could continue, and it's increasingly international, I guess, as it is dominated by the big tech companies who earn kind of half their earnings abroad. And then the UK is dominated by minerals, oil, mining, this kind of stuff, and then cyclical value stocks. And so I guess kind of you could make the argument that one day people will view indices in terms of what type of stocks they expose you to and the factors rather than the country itself.
I think that's true. I think that's true. But the other trend you've had is you've had these new markets come, so you've had China as opening up, and China becomes a bigger and bigger part of portfolios. In the Middle East, you've had a number of the Middle East companies open up, and they're now becoming a bigger part of global portfolios. But I do think we're heading for a world where the combination of the US and China will dominate global portfolios. Yeah, and technology will be a large part of both the US and the China indices. And I think that's just the world as it is evolving, and the indices must reflect the way the world is evolving. So I think as we look forward, I think just by the fact that China becomes a bigger and bigger part of global portfolios, other countries like the UK and even countries like Japan will shrink in terms of their size relative to the overall global market. I see a world where, you know, within 5 years, we're probably looking at 65% of global portfolios is made up of just the US and China, 65-70%. And if that's the case, really, your decisions about those two markets will determine whether or not you outperform global equities.
So another major talking point about the FTSE 100 is its lack of tech companies. There's obviously a couple, but compared to other major indices, there's a kind of distinct lack of tech. Became particularly apparent this year as kind of tech stocks outperformed other kind of stocks. Yeah. So why does the FTSE lack tech companies, and what, if anything, can or should be done about it?
I think it lacks large tech companies. I think it has a lot of tech industry that has done very, very well. But they're smaller companies, and as they get larger, they very often get bought out by these large companies. And then the reason for that is, if you look to the US, the private equity market and the venture capital markets in the US are just huge, and they provide funding for these companies to develop in the private market. So they're coming to market much bigger size, and they have access to that funding. So, you know, you will see much more tech that is funded out of the US. And also in China, where you've got the central government trying to support these large tech companies in a much bigger way, I think it's the combination of those two is really been the drive behind technology and the large technology companies that we're seeing. So I don't think it's necessarily that the UK is not producing technology companies. It is, but they're smaller, and they don't have that financial support that you see in the US or China. And it will be difficult to see how to develop that, certainly to the same scale as either of those two countries.
That makes sense. So you mentioned in the book, The Rise of Passive Investing, which obviously very important for anyone who provides an index, particularly ETFs in the 90s. You used to kind of say introduce a new business model for index providers. So, you know, it's quite different from being a performance benchmark for active managers to instead being something that fund managers directly replicate. So one, you can walk us through kind of put the company's kind of growth in the ETF and indexing industry.
The ETF market, it was an innovation coming out of the US. Even today, the US market is, you know, huge compared to the ETF markets around the world. But it really spurred on a change in indexation from being an industry that was trying to measure the various markets and parts of markets to help performance measurement and research, to one where it was, you know, actively supporting the creation of passive vehicles. And I think we then had it spurred even further because it started to challenge active management. Because the attraction of the index funds is two things. It's one is its low cost, and the other is that it has much greater transparency. And those two in combination are very powerful. And then Rob Arnott came along with ideas about actually you could create indices around investment themes or investment practices. And I met up with Rob and actually CalPERS brought us together because CalPERS wanted to trial these what have become known as smart beta, the first smart beta indices. I worked with Robbie in providing those. The first were fundamental indices.
CalPERS is a California pension fund.
That's right. CalPERS, the Californian pension fund. And that received fierce criticism from the industry because suddenly we were moving away from cap-weighted indices. And here we were really following and replacing investment strategies, but doing it in a systematic way. I think that spurred a huge growth and, as you say, another change in the sort of business model for index providers. And we've seen that growth. And we're now seeing that evolve even further because, you know, what we have seen is public markets, because money is cheap, are shrinking relative to private markets. And people are looking to get exposure for private markets, for fixed income, for alternatives in a much low cost and much more transparent way. So the index providers are starting to move into those markets. And I think you'll continue to see this growth in indexation due to just those two factors. It is the low cost and the greater transparency.
Thanks, Mark. Last question. What do you see as the future of indexing?
Look, I think the market is still exciting. We're three big players in the equity market. But there are many, many index providers. And I do see the index world moving much more to a sort of multi-asset and a mass customization approach. And I think at the heart of it will be asset allocation. And I think they'll work with active and passive managers so that, you know, you have an even bigger offering in terms of indexation. So I think it will be the challenge for investors to look at this choice and think about how best to invest. But they will almost have a wealth of choice. The indexation and the index providers will be working, I think, with very strong relationships with wealth managers and fund managers around the world in providing that choice.
Thanks for that, Mark. A lot to think about. And thanks, everyone, for listening. If you found any of that interesting, I strongly encourage you to buy a copy of Mark's book, FTSE, The Inside Story. I'm not exaggerating when I say this is one of the best books I've read all year.